Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.
Breaking news from The Source tonight. As America is on high alert, bracing for what senior U.S. officials are calling a significant attack by Iran on Israeli or American targets in the Middle East. Both countries now working to find who or what they plan to strike and when. Also tonight, aftershocks from a rare earthquake that rattled New York City, shaking the Northeast from Boston all the way to Baltimore, prompting millions of people to ask each other, did you just feel that? One of the country's foremost quake experts, Dr. Lucy Jones, is our source tonight. And with 10 days until his first criminal trial gets underway, Donald Trump is making a last-minute push tonight to get the judge kicked off his hush money case by taking aim at his daughter yet again. I'm Caitlin Collins, and this is The Source. Senior U.S. officials are calling it, quote, inevitable. And tonight, the American and Israeli governments are both actively preparing for what they say could be a significant attack by Iran. Revenge for Israeli strikes that took out some of Iran's top and senior most commanders. The Iranian attack, we are told, could happen within the next week, somewhere in the Middle East. But right now, we are hearing that neither government knows exactly where, when, or how Iran plans to strike. What we do know is the two governments are working to get in position for whatever is coming their way. Our sources are telling us that this potential retaliation was a major topic during that call that happened yesterday between President Biden and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Among the worst-case scenarios here would be a direct strike by Iran on Israeli soil. But that is exactly what Biden officials say that they are bracing for tonight. It's not only a worst-case scenario because it would rapidly escalate Israel's war with Iran's proxy, Hamas, but the fear is also that it could lead to a much broader conflict across the region, which is something that no one wants to see happen. Let's get straight to the source tonight with former Defense Secretary under former President Trump, Mark Esper, who is now a CNN political commentator. And Secretary Esper, it's great to have you because what we're hearing from these sources is that senior U.S. officials and their counterparts believe that this is inevitable. You know, it's not clear where or when. But can you just kind of walk us through what's happening inside the Pentagon? What's happening inside the Situation Room right now as they try to make these assessments?
Yeah, sure thing, Caitlin. And as you mentioned, I think, you know, I've had the benefit of going through this when we struck Soleimani on January 3rd, 2020, and then had to figure out fully expecting that Iran would respond, how and when they would do that. Now, we had very good intelligence about that, but we knew this much, and I think these are principles applying this situation as well. They are going to act. They're going to feel the need to uphold their dignity, to maintain credibility with their proxies throughout the region, and to really meet the demands of hardliners within the theocracy that want to see something done. But on the other hand, they're not going to want to make this a wider war. They don't want to escalate. They know that a major conflict with Israel, let alone Israel and the United States, would be disastrous for Iran. So I suspect that they will limit the attack to Israel, Israeli targets. As you mentioned, I don't think I'd be surprised if they attack Israel proper. And so the question is, will they look at other sites in the region? Maybe there's an outpost somewhere that we're not aware of. It could be go as far as maybe, you know, there are Israeli diplomatic facilities in UAE, which is not far from Iran. Because keep in mind, Iran is at least 1,000 miles away from Israel. So That's a tough target to strike. They're not going to use aircraft. I doubt that they would use ballistic missiles. But has been postured, as we're hearing, as maybe your reporting is telling you, they're thinking about some type of drones or cruise missiles, which have the benefit of giving you some degree of unpredictability in terms of how they fly. So they could be used to strike some type of, again, military, maybe a Mossad outpost, something like that would allow Iran to take an eye for an eye, because that's the culture we're dealing with.
Well, I mean, one of the first things that my mind went to, though, when MJ Lee reported this earlier from the White House is, I mean, there's American troops in the region, in Syria and in Iraq. What is the likelihood? I mean, what's the concern inside the Pentagon that they could be a target?
Sure. Again, I don't think we would be because I think Iran knows that we weren't involved. And secondly, they would not want to strike the United States because the United States would act as a restraint on Israel should this start getting out of control. They know Biden does not want a larger war. But back to the Pentagon. Look, we would be taking every preparation to make sure that our positions were hardened. We were protecting the troops. We were doing everything defensively we can to protect our positions. But at the same time, quietly moving things, forces in place in case we had to respond quickly, or to at least have ready for the president as many options as possible in case this does get out of control and the president wants some type of response. So you'll see a combination of first defensive moves, again, hardening, sheltering, protecting the force, our capabilities, but then secondly, also making preparations in case there's some type of response is needed.
You noted how the Pentagon has made quite clear that they were not aware of the strike that Israel was going to conduct. I mean, they've gone out of their way to say that the Pentagon, or they said the State Department said that they communicated that through channels to Iran. I mean, how much does Tehran listen to that? And how much stock do they put in a denial like that?
You know, they did. There is some reporting that they said something like, we asked them not to attack us. We pleaded not to attack us, which I think the administration described as spin, and properly so. But I will tell you, after, after the Soleimani strike and they hit back at us very quietly through the intermediaries of the Swedish embassy, I think it was, or maybe the Swiss embassy, they told us they were done. They had no more. They didn't want a bigger fight. So, look, I think the communications behind the scenes through the intermediaries is pretty clear, pretty frank. And I think that's going to be a conduit going forward over the coming days.
Secretary Mark Esper, you have a great experience on this, and thanks for joining us tonight with your expertise.
Thank you, Caitlin.
And we also have two other excellent sources with us tonight. Bob Baer, who is the former CIA operations officer who spent more than two decades working in the region, and also retired Lieutenant General Mark Hertling, who commanded U.S. Army forces in Europe and is now a CNN military analyst. It's great to have both of you here. General Hertling, let me just start with you, because I think a big question here is the options that Iran has when it comes to hitting Israel. I mean, the concerns is not just Israeli assets, but also American assets. I mean, how limited are Iran's options, or do you feel like they're kind of broad here?
I believe they're broad, Caitlin. And what former Secretary Esper was talking about was primarily the military strikes within Israel. What I think is the potential for happening is a much wider range. And the military looks at this from the most dangerous course of action of the enemy to the most likely course of action of the enemy. And I think Secretary Esper was talking about the most likely. But there are dangerous options here that Iranian forces could do. This is the Quds force. There could be the potential of striking in Israel. And at this time, after a weekend where President Biden has scolded Prime Minister Netanyahu, tensions are erupting between Israel and the U.S., and the context of this situation could cause different actions. It would be very difficult if Israel got attacked, and they are becoming sort of a pariah on the world stage, especially in the Middle East, for the United States to immediately come to their aid. And I think Iran is weighing that. But as the Secretary also said, you're talking about multiple forces, U.S. forces in Jordan, in Iraq, in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar, in the UAE. We have forces throughout that area at different bases. And so they are all preparing for any kind of action that might come against them, while also preparing to assist in anything that might occur against Israel.
Bob, what would you be looking for at this moment?
The easiest way for Iran to hit Israel is using the proxy of Hezbollah. And they have direct control over some of those forces. And at any moment, they could roll rockets out, solid fueled, and fire them into Israel. You fire enough of them at the same time, you can swarm Israeli air defenses, Iron Dome. You can hit Haifa for clearly. You could also hit Tel Aviv. That would be for the Iranians. You know, one or two drones, I think the Israelis could knock down. We also have our forces in Iraq, which are subject to pro-Iranian militias. Our bases could be hit at any time. The American embassy could be hit at any time. It's well protected, but a large force under Iran's control could hit us. And as far as terrorism, you know, the Iranians can hit the Israelis anywhere in Europe. They could even hit them in the United States. There are Iranian sleeper cells here, as we know from Salman Rushdie, that could be brought to bear. So they have a broad options. And as everybody's been talking about, it's the problem of escalation. And if we move to escalation, the Iranians certainly would take out the Gulf's oil facilities, infrastructure. And they've done this before. They hit Abqaiq, and they would move to that in the case of escalation. They don't want to escalate, but I agree that they, at this point, that they need to respond in order to keep their proxies in line and save their credibility.
Well, General Hartling, after, you know, feeling the need to escalate, and you heard Secretary Esper there talking about when the Soleimani strike happened, I mean, there was kind of this fear among experts that there was going to be a serious escalation then. But then you saw Iran kind of respond in a rather limited way for what people were expecting. The U.S. did not respond to that. I mean, is that a pathway here, or does it seem clear from these warnings that something's going to happen?
Yeah, I think you have to consider the context of the current situation versus what happened in the strike against Soleimani. That was a one-off strike. It was a singular action by the United States against a terrorist or an Al-Quds target that was in Iraq. Now we're talking about an ongoing war, a six-month war plus that's been going on in Iran, where the fears of various Shia militias within the area, all pro-Iranian, and as Bob said, it could come from Hezbollah, it could come from the PMF forces in any number of countries in the Middle East. It's just that the context is different today. It's an inflamed Gulf. I spent a lot of time in Iraq, and I think they're going to be put between the rock and a hard place in this particular action because they're trying to tamp down the Iranian militias inside of Iraq right now. They haven't been successful in doing that. But if Iran strikes inside of Israel or nearby or causes their proxies to strike, as Bob just said, this could escalate very quickly. And it's been counter to what the Biden administration has been attempting to do, is to keep this not inflamed into a regional war. And that could happen very quickly in this situation. I'm very concerned about what we're seeing right now.
Yeah. And Bob, on that note, you know, this warning came about kind of suddenly today. I think everyone had been bracing ever since the Israeli strike happened that there could be retaliation. But it was noticeable that this came down suddenly from the administration today saying that, yes, they are bracing for this. What kind of intelligence would lead them to essentially say, make that warning?
Yeah, well, first of all, General Hurdling's absolutely right. It's the context. This war has been going on for 6 months. The Iranians have been holding back so far. The problem is that we don't know what goes on in the inner circles in Iran. There's no way to know. All those discussions are held face-to-face. Same way with Hezbollah. We can generally see preparations for a strike on Israel, but we don't know whether they're going to follow through or not. It's just impossible to get in these circles. Both Hezbollah, as I said, and Iran, we just don't know what they're going to do next. And the fact that we haven't got a back-channel message saying, don't worry, should worry us.
Bob Baer and General Mark Hurtling, great to have you both on as we continue to monitor this developing situation. Thank you.
Thanks, Caitlin.
Ahead, we're also following this situation here in New York as aftershocks after that rare earthquake in the Northeast. It is the strongest to rumble New York City in more than a century and more than two in New Jersey, leaving many things and many people shaken. Plus, Donald Trump's new attempt to oust the judge overseeing his first criminal trial, yes, again, this time just days before that trial is set to begin.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life.
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
There have now been more than a dozen aftershocks since this morning's historic 4.8 magnitude earthquake originating from New Jersey, including one that was a magnitude 4 just a few hours ago. This morning's quakes and tremors across the Northeast that left many people, especially here in New York City, including myself, wondering what just happened. And I know, our viewers on the West Coast watching right now might be rolling their eyes at us, but this doesn't often happen here. So let us have our moment.
Is this an earthquake? Yo, is this an earthquake?
That was basically my reaction. This morning's quake was the strongest to hit New Jersey in more than 240 years. The Empire State Building was among the first to reassure other New Yorkers, tweeting, quote, I am fine. This was the view from the Statue of Liberty. You can see here, even the shakes. Listen to the sounds of this baby monitor. Don't worry, that is an empty crib that you were looking at there, but it is just about a mile from the epicenter, and you can see just how serious the shakes were there. I should note there have been no reported injuries or serious damage, thankfully, but there was a lot of levity coming with this earthquake today. Some people ironically remarking, we survived and we will rebuild. Welcome news, given how unpredictable these events can sometimes be. And no one knows that better than the source on all things earthquakes, Dr. Lucy Jones, a seismologist who worked for the U.S. Geological Survey for more than 3 decades and joins me now. And it's so great to have you here, Dr. Jones, because, you know, this is not exactly part of the country that is accustomed to this. And I wonder what stands out to you, our foremost expert, about what happened here in New Jersey and in New York.
A couple of things. One is a reminder that earthquakes really can happen anywhere. You just have them a lot less often if you're in New York. And I think the other part is how the East Coast earthquakes are felt over a larger area than the same size earthquake in California. Because the rock where you are is old and cold and hard, and just like a really hard, dense steel bell, it'll ring for a long time. Here on the West Coast, we're broken up with a lot of faults. And so when the earthquake happens and the waves start traveling out, they get disrupted by all the faults in the way, and it doesn't travel nearly as far. So this earthquake was felt by an extremely large number of people in a much larger area than we would have had here in California.
Okay, that's really fascinating, because it was kind of something where people in D.C. were asking if they had felt it in Philadelphia. Obviously, here in New York, everyone is talking about it. And the thing is, it's continued. I mean, there have been more than a dozen aftershocks so far. There was one just a few hours ago as we were prepping for the show that was a 4.0. How long should we expect these to go on for?
They'll be going on at some level for quite a while. I mean, we define it as an aftershock as long as the rate of earthquakes is above what it was before the main shock happened. And the rate there was very low, so you could technically be having aftershocks for years. But probably there will be more felt earthquakes within the next few days, and the chances of getting one that's large enough to be felt will go down pretty quickly.
Did you say years?
Yeah, there's a rather famous, this equation to describe how aftershocks decay was developed in 1890 in Japan, and 100 years later, it was still following the same decay pattern. So technically, they were still aftershocks.
Okay, we'll be preparing for that. I'll be sure to make sure for years to come. I did not have that on my calendar when I got up this morning. But, you know, when we were looking at the numbers here, and this was the most powerful earthquake in New Jersey in more than 240 years. Yes. I mean, you know, you talk about how this happens more often than we think and that it happens in more places than we should be surprised by. But, you know, what does this say about how often this could happen going forward?
This shouldn't really change the rate of earthquakes in New Jersey. I mean, right at this location, we'll probably be seeing some more aftershocks over the next year or so. But over a larger area, it's partly, I'll be rude, your states are a little small. So defining it by the state isn't a very big area, right? If you look at the Northeast, there's been 98 earthquakes in the last 30 years above magnitude 3. And that rate is probably going to continue. So several earthquakes a year above magnitude 3, and 1 out of 10 of those is going to be bigger than magnitude 4.
Well, okay, you can be rude about the size of our states. I'll also be rude about our buildings, because most of our buildings in New York were built, you know, before earthquake provisions were kind of added. I think it was in the mid-90s in New York. And so if this had been worse, you know, I live in a very old house. What would that have meant for damage that we could have seen here in Manhattan?
It depends on how much bigger and where. Because that thing I said, it travels farther on the East Coast, but it's still really right on top of the earthquake that you see the larger shaking. If you took this earthquake and put it in the borough of Manhattan, you could have been having damage. If you now make it a bit larger, you're almost certainly going to be having some damage. The one thing to be said is having some damage and actually really hurting people are two different things. The most dangerous type of buildings are what are called unreinforced masonry, buildings where they're made out of brick and it's the brick wall that's holding up the roof. And those, unfortunately, are pretty common on the East Coast. And you put a strong enough earthquake in it, you're going to see a lot of problems.
Can I just ask you one last question? Because, you know, a lot of people on the East Coast don't know what to do in the event of an earthquake. I don't. I'm from Alabama, which is also probably part of that. But the mayor, Eric Adams, put out some outdated advice today, telling people to take cover in a doorway, which I know is not what you are supposed to do.
Right. We've been able to unify as a earthquake community to say the best thing to do is drop, cover, hold on, which means get to the floor before the earthquake sends you there. You didn't have such strong shaking, but make it a bit stronger. And it's very difficult to stand. You really can't move in an earthquake without hurting yourself. So drop to the ground before the earthquake puts you there. Cover under sturdy furniture. Getting under a desk is really like the best possible thing. Even if there's failure in your building, it'll protect you from that, and it protects you from flying objects. And then we say, hold on, because a big enough earthquake, that table's not staying in one place, and you want to make sure it stays above you.
Where did that doorway thing come from?
Oh, it's actually from the 1952 Kern County earthquake, where there was an old adobe, you know, Mexican adobe house that, you know, hundreds of years old, and made out of mud. So the mud dissolves and the wood frame still was standing, the wood door frame, lintel. And literally a Red Cross person saw this and went, wow, look, that must be a good place to be. And the Red Cross started recommending standing in doorways. But, you know, doorways usually have doors. And when they get swinging in an earthquake, that can be a problem.
Dr. Lucy Jones, great to have you. Thank you for joining me.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Up next, we are digging into the last-ditch bid by Donald Trump before his first criminal trial gets underway, testing the boundaries of a newly expanded gag order, focusing on the judge's daughter again in a new attempt to get him removed from the case. As part of Donald Trump's last-minute attempts to delay his first criminal trial, his social media rants are morphing into actual court motions tonight. 4 days ago, a reminder, he was hit with that gag order for attacking the judge, Juan Merchan's daughter, online. It was expanded to include her so he could no longer attack her. Well, now a new filing from his legal team tries to argue the judge in the hush money case must step aside because his adult daughter, quote, has direct financial interest in the proceedings. The truth is, her business has nothing to do with the trial itself. She consults for Democratic candidates. But the presumptive Republican presidential nominee is 10 days away from a reality that he has never faced, that no other former president has ever faced. It's a criminal trial and proceedings that go with it, with the threat of possible jail time. I'm joined tonight by a former U.S. District Court judge for the Southern District of New York, Shira Shenlin. And Judge, it's great to have you back on The Source here twice in 1 week, which shows you how many legal filings we're dealing with. I just wonder, what would your response be to a motion like this 10 days before you're set to go to trial?
Well, I wouldn't be pleased to get it 10 days before, but I had the chance to read the motion. And they've put together a composite of issues that would cause me a little bit of pause. And I can explain all the various things that they've put together. The main focus of this motion, as opposed to the previous one a year ago, which the judge denied, is on the daughter's line of work. As you already said, the daughter does work with many, many high-profile Democratic candidates. She works on their social media. They put out a post, they get contributions. She, as an owner, gets a percentage of those contributions. So there is a statute in New York which says a judge must disqualify himself if a person known by the judge to be within the sixth degree of relationship, and a daughter is the first degree, has an interest that could be substantially affected by the outcome of the proceeding. So the question here is this daughter likely to profit, to benefit from the outcome of this proceeding. And you have to understand, it's not actual conduct that's worrisome. It's the appearance to a reasonable person that this judge cannot be fair and impartial given that relationship. So ordinarily, I would think that a benefit financially would be to a spouse because they share the income. This is an independent adult daughter. They don't share income. Mm-hmm. But according to this statute, the judge must recuse if she would substantially benefit from the outcome. So that's one thing that concerned me. But if you add to that a few other facts that are of concern, at least to me, was the judge's original contribution to President Biden 4 years ago, which he made himself, very small contribution,
$35. Yeah, I think it was $10, right?
$35, I'm told, $35, a small contribution, but he made it through ActBlue himself on the internet. He did give an interview where he said he wouldn't comment on the case, but then he said he's been intensely preparing and he wants to be fair and impartial and justice is important. He and his daughter discussed the former president's use of social media, which the judge condemned in that discussion, and she, the daughter, reported on it. The Office of Court Administration said the daughter's Twitter account ended a year ago, so any recent posts on that were not from the daughter. Yeah. And I kind of wondered why the Office of Court Administration was defending the daughter. So there, if you put all these together, is my point. It's certainly enough that maybe a reasonable person could have a doubt about impartiality. So I think it's kind of a serious motion. I realize it's 10 days before the trial and don't expect it to be granted.
Okay, so you don't expect it to be granted. But, you know, looking through it, this is all information that was available to them before this was one thing. And the comment about having an intense schedule, I was confused how that could be construed as him weighing in on, you know, saying it's going to be an intensive proceeding, how that could be construed.
You're absolutely right.
Go
ahead. He did not opine in any way on the merits of the case. You're absolutely right. But being a sitting judge being interviewed at all and saying, I've been intensely preparing, that's what he said, this is going to be intense, and my preparation has been very intense, it could be construed as commenting. I'm just saying if you put six or seven things in that motion together, and I'm not sure that all of them were known, this really digs into the daughter's financial stake in this company, Authentic, and how she earns money from the posts and from her work with these candidates. And it explains that she takes a percentage of the take. So when they advertise the arraignment or the indictment and tens of millions come into these candidates around the country, she gets a percentage of that. So it's the appearance that is of concern to me. I'm not saying that the judge did anything wrong or will do anything wrong. And I'm sure he can be fair. But yeah. The question is to the reasonable person on the street, is there an appearance of impropriety?
We'll see.
Or could there be an appearance of bias?
We'll see what the judge here decides. Judge Shira Shinlin, it's always great to have you on.
Thank you.
Here tonight, we have former federal prosecutor Shan Wu. Shan, what do you make of what you heard from Judge Shinlin there? And also, you know, this decision now before Judge Mershon that he turned down last year. But as she noted, they're kind of, it's a little bit lengthy of an argument that they're making about his daughter this time around.
Well, with all due respect to Her Honor, the only thing I agree with her about is that it's highly unlikely to be granted. It's directed to Judge Mershon again. He's going to turn it down again. And the arguments that they make are very, very weak. I mean, this is the judge's adult daughter, but the way I think about it is, imagine if the judge had an elementary school kid who had drawn a picture of Trump as a clown, and Trump's lawyers saying, look at that, you know, you're going to be biased against me. It's completely irrelevant. The idea that she would benefit from the outcome of the trial, if you take a look at that narrowly, makes no sense. The fact that her company may be benefiting from the idea that this is a highly publicized trial or there's a lot of politics going on and they're political operatives, that's totally removed from an interest in the outcome of the trial. Whether Trump's convicted or acquitted has no relationship to her company's work.
Can I ask you a question, you know, beyond the merits of the argument here? She's now included in the gag order. And, you know, in this filing, her name, the judge's daughter's name is the second sentence in here. You know, how does that overlap or does it not overlap at all? If it's in a gag order, they can still make an argument about it in a filing. How does that work?
I think it's a very clever way of trying to get around the gag order. Let's file a whole bunch of motions that lay out the same things that he would like to post about on social media, but he's a little bit constrained now because of the gag order. So in the filings, they can talk about it, although I suppose the judge could actually take the extra step of placing those under seal.
Shan Wu, we're going to watch all of this closely. I have a feeling it won't be the last filing we see from the Trump team.
I agree.
Meanwhile, a presidential candidate not named, Donald Trump, is now questioning whether January 6th was a, quote, true insurrection. You're going to want to hear our explainer right after this.
The assignment with me, Audie Cornish. So there have been arrests, suspensions, disciplinary hearings. They're shutting down graduation events.
At this moment, the part of the protests that are admirable are young people calling attention to atrocities.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University.
I would like to make a space for them to do that, as long as that space doesn't prevent other people from pursuing their education.
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. choosing to whitewash January 6th. In a new statement today, the vaccine skeptic turned presidential candidate downplaying what you see happening here and what we all saw happen on that day. He's also pledging that if he is elected president of the United States, he'll appoint a special counsel to investigate the Justice Department's efforts to prosecute the rioters that you see here forcing their way through the halls of Congress. He says that, quote, reasonable people tell him that day wasn't a, quote, true insurrection. Maybe the most apt line of his statement was this one, though. I have not examined the evidence in detail. That much is abundantly clear. Given this, the mob of people forcing their way into the Capitol. But what about this one? Police officers finding themselves in hand-to-hand combat. Somehow he just happened to miss all of that evidence. His newest statement is coming after his campaign called the rioters activists yesterday, who had been, quote, stripped of their constitutional liberties. That one, they tried to walk back. But I should note, none of this is exactly new coming from Mr. Kennedy.
What's the worst thing that could happen, right? I mean, we have an entire military Pentagon a few blocks away. You can rebuild a Capitol.
Given the fact that Kennedy, who I should note 13% of Americans right now say they would like to be the next commander-in-chief, is pushing these lies, we wanted to take a moment tonight to set the record straight. In his second attempt at a cleanup in as many days, and in response to a CNN request for comment, he's already retracting part of his claim that those same reasonable people tell him protesters carried no weapons. The truth is, folks like Guy Reffitt are serving time for bringing a gun onto Capitol grounds that day. Or because court documents show that Christopher Alberts was arrested carrying a loaded pistol and 25 rounds of ammunition. There's also Mark Ibrahim, an off-duty agent for the DEA who was charged with bringing his service weapon on Capitol grounds. That's all before you get to the guy who was arrested with a pistol and a rifle, who showed up too late for the riot, but had talked about killing Nancy Pelosi. Or the man who parked a truck with 11 homemade bombs, a handgun, and a rifle just two blocks away from the Capitol. In all, the Justice Department has said 122 people faced charges connected with carrying weapons on that day. That includes guns, stun guns, knives, batons, baseball bats, flagpoles, and chemical sprays. RFK Jr.'s statement also claims that none of the rioters had plans to overthrow the government. Even as more than a dozen members of the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys have been convicted of or already pleaded guilty to sedition. And the idea that this is all politically motivated by the Biden administration completely ignores the fact that the prosecutions began almost immediately while Donald Trump was still in office. I'm joined tonight by someone who knows all this all too well, former Congressman Adam Kinzinger, a Republican who served on the January 6th Congressional Committee and is now a CNN senior political commentator. Congressman, part of the statement, you know, that I just can't get over. I have not examined the evidence in detail. You obviously did examine it in detail. What would you say to him tonight?
Oh, I mean, I could go on for a 20-minute segment on this. You know, look, what you named on the people that were found with weapons, there's this idea that somehow the government knows everybody that was carrying weapons anyway. The government was unable to arrest everybody that day, or really many people that day, because they were fighting for survival of their own lives in the Capitol. That's why there weren't that many arrests, because they had no place to take them to. You can't take them into the middle of a war zone. So the vast majority of those people left the Capitol grounds, and we have no idea who else was armed, because it's not like we have, you know, X-ray vision and we can go through the tape and see that. Look, this is one of the more insane ramblings I've heard from him, and I've heard some insane ramblings. When he says, "I haven't looked at the evidence in detail," You were around politicians a long time. You know how a politician is trying to like skate when they say things like, "We have to take a deep look at something," or mm-hmm. "We need to have a conversation about it," is a way of punting because they don't want to answer. This is his way of pleasing those that want to hear that he just hasn't looked at the evidence in detail and winking to the MAGA folks. I mean, here's the thing, Caitlin. His campaign has been hijacked by MAGA. Maybe not hijacked, maybe voluntarily. And so you're going to start seeing more and more of this kind of Donald Trump conspiracies. And he's either going along with it because that's going to help him raise money and get notoriety, or he truly believes it. Regardless, he's absolutely wrong. And this is a frightening thing.
Well, and it also comes the same week that he, you know, both campaigns have been worried about him, certainly more so the Biden campaign. But it comes after he said that he believed Biden was a bigger threat to democracy than Donald Trump. And when, you know, you're looking at what happened on January 6th and exactly what Donald Trump did or did not do that day, I mean, it just makes those comments seem even richer in hindsight.
Look, you can dislike Joe Biden, like, but you can't with a straight face. It's not even subjective. This is like fact. You can't with a straight face say that Joe Biden's a bigger danger to democracy. Joe Biden has gone along with democracy as he's president. He's gone along with the rules of democracy. He's not tried to overthrow any election results. You know, the other thing he said is, what is it, like not a true insurrection or something along that line, not a real insurrection. It's like, I looked up the definition of insurrection just before this segment, and it's like a violent uprising against an authority or government. So what part of a violent uprising against an authority or government was not a true insurrection? Was it not violent? Was it not against the government? Like, it's a pretty basic definition. It's absolutely an insurrection. And he's just trying to get these MAGA folks to give him money. They give money to Donald Trump, and they're probably giving some money to him. I mean, his super PAC is being run by Republicans, for God's sakes.
Well, what does it say, though, that there are 13% of Americans who right now, who knows how they'll vote once November comes, but that want him to be president at this moment?
I think it's basically two quick things. It's like, so either he, you know, they just still hear the Robert F. Kennedy name and there's some intrigue, or they like the fact that he's kind of outside of the establishment. I'm not sure that 13% number holds up in the long term, though.
Congressman Adam Kinzinger, great to have you on. Thank you very much.
Of course.
And on another note, as you look at the calendar, it is almost hard to believe that this weekend will mark 6 months since the October 7th terrorist attack on Israel that killed 1,200 people. Tonight, more than 130 hostages are still being held captive in Gaza. And CNN's Bianca Golodryga traveled to Israel and spoke with four hostage families, heartbroken, desperate to get their loved ones back, including the mother of 19-year-old Nama Levy.
Dr. Ayelet Levy-Shahar didn't get Nama back, but she did learn how her 19-year-old daughter was coping in captivity from released hostages who said they saw her.
From what she told them, she was alone for over 40 days, wow. Alone with her captors, moving from one hiding place to the other. She told them that she didn't eat much. They described her injuries. She has a lot of shrapnel wounds. Her legs are very swollen and she has burns.
Burns
on her legs.
From what?
Probably from a grenade that went off in the attack just before she was kidnapped. I worry most that she will despair and that she will stop fighting from inside. You know, stop hoping. And this is what I keep telling her in my mind, you know, don't stop. Just stick in there, hang in there. Don't darken. Keep the hope and keep moving. you know, physically and mentally, keep moving.
And you can see Bianna's full report on the whole story with Anderson Cooper this Sunday, 8 p.m. Eastern. Question for you tonight. Would you pay $1,000 to stay just one night at a Super 8 hotel in Grayville, Illinois? Because that's the going rate this weekend for a room that usually goes for about $95. As millions of people are traveling to the Path of Totality to get the best view of Monday's solar eclipse, that includes my next guest. From the Super 8 to the Ritz-Carlton, prices for this weekend are up nearly 10 times the normal rates. Many hotels completely sold out. Here to discuss, astrophysicist and NASA advisor Paul Sutter. And Paul, it's great to have you back. First off, let me ask, do you have your travel and your hotel all set and all booked for this for Monday?
Oh, I absolutely do. I would not miss this.
And how far in advance did you have to book?
Just to be sure, about a year ago, I actually booked four different hotels along the path because I wasn't exactly sure where I was going to end up. And I was able to cancel those hotels as my plans firmed up. And I will be in Indianapolis for this upcoming eclipse.
And what made you pick Indianapolis?
Actually, I will be covering the eclipse live all day long with the Weather Channel, providing all day coverage. And so I get to enjoy it and share my joy with the country. It's going to be such a fun event.
Yeah, well, make sure you go to St. Elmo's Steakhouse. It's so good. Okay, but there's the one part of this that I'm serious. There's one part of this that we are so fascinated by, and it's called the Purkinje effect. And I'm assuming most people, like I didn't before this, know what that is. Can you just kind of walk us through what it is and why it's going to affect how people are seeing colors in certain ways on Monday when the eclipse is underway?
Yes, one of the many cool things about the eclipse is the way it messes with our normal rhythms and our normal physiology. In this case, the Purkinje effect, which is named after a Polish scientist who first identified this, happens when our eyes switch from primarily bright day mode, which uses the cones in our retina, to night mode, which uses the rods in our retina. Usually that transition takes, you know, 30 to 45 minutes as dusk settles in, and that's what our eyes are adapted to doing. But during totality, it will plunge from a bright sunny afternoon to the middle of the night in a matter of minutes, and that's not fast enough for our eye to catch up. And so we get these like crossed wires and mixed up signals. And what you'll see is that reds will become very, very muted and blues and greens will pop out of the gray background. It'll be a very interesting effect.
Oh, so what color are you going to be wearing on Monday?
You know what? I don't know if I am going to be looking for this effect because I don't think anything is going to take my eyes off of the eclipse itself.
You know, I was thinking for everyone who is, you know, put so much effort into planning, like you have a year out in advance, you know, we've been watching the weather forecast very closely here at CNN. And I know that it's going to be cloudy in some of these areas that are in the path to totality. What effect will that have, or will they still be able to have, you know, a great eclipse viewing experience, even if it is a little bit overcast?
It's a little bit bittersweet. I was clouded out. I was in Nashville for the 2017 eclipse, and our location got clouded out with 2 minutes to spare. And you get a lot of the really cool effects. You get the darkening of the sky. You get to hear the birds and insects come out because they think twilight is here. And you definitely sense that something strange is happening in the sky. But if it's clouded, you don't get to see the fire around the moon. You don't get to see the beauty and just sheer cosmic majesty of totality. So if you are mobile, be mobile. Get to a sunny patch because I guarantee that there is nothing like this that you have ever experienced before in your life.
Paul Sutter, we all can't wait. We'll be watching it here in New York. Good luck in Indianapolis. Thank you all so much for joining us. And we'll see you all on Monday for our special coverage of the eclipse. CNN Newsnight starts right now.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, A new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.